Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Oh, those Europeans, never a dull moment, huh? Election results and austerity on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 7th of May. Good to have you with us. The never-ending fiscal drama that is the European Union has once again not disappointed. The two countries that are arguably either at or really, really close to the economic center of the European debt crisis had elections over the weekend. Socialist François Hollande will be sworn in Paris on May the 15th. He won on a distinctly anti-austerity program. Greek voters, meanwhile, punished the two biggest political parties there for the belt tightening that German Chancellor Angela Merkel has been demanding for months now. So we're going to hopscotch around Europe for a little bit of analysis right now. Franz-Olivier Gesbert is the editor of the French weekly news magazine Le Point. And I asked him when we spoke this morning whether French voters might be in a little bit of denial about their economic reality.
They are in a kind of denial, but they are very afraid. So they know that it's going to be less easy than it was. And they know that.
Does this election of Monsieur Hollande and his eventual cabinet and ministers, does it make it more or less likely that this thing that we over here call the European debt crisis will come to some kind of satisfactory conclusion, do you think?
Well, it's very difficult to say, because when you see the program of Mr. Hollande, he's not dedicated to this problem in the country. But Mr. Hollande is very smart, very pragmatic. If his program is not dedicated to the debt crisis, I think himself would be dedicated to the debt crisis.
There was much talk during this election of the Merkozy alliance, Angela Merkel and Mr.
That's
Sarkozy.
Right, that's right.
Will
yeah.
there be a Merkeland? I mean, he's going to see, the new president is going to see the German chancellor in a couple of weeks.
Yes, yes. And I'm sure in some weeks, I wouldn't say some days, of course, but in some weeks, things are going to get better. Because it was always the case between the German chancellor and the French president. And at the end, they were the best friends.
Franz-Olivier Gesbert at the French news magazine Le Point right there. Down in Athens, Greece, meanwhile, Antonis Papianidis publishes a magazine called Economic Monthly.
People are running scared because they voted with their hearts and not with their minds. And now they have to collect.
What's supposed to happen then? I mean, do you think the Germans are actually going to look at Greece now and say, oh, yeah, we'll keep on funding whatever bailout programs we have in place? Or are they going to say, the heck with you guys if you're going to do this?
I believe that B will be correct. I mean, Germans will more or less point a finger at us and say, you've been missing your targets. So you either get out of the euro or you die locally. The people, I mean, Greeks, have voted for the easy way out, meaning they have been venting anger at their political leaders. And now we have a total impasse, meaning we go nowhere.
It has to go somewhere, sir, though, right? Because the debt is real. The probability of a default is now real again. The question of leaving the euro is very real again. It has to go somewhere.
Yes, but the saving of Greece on the part of Europe has been really a way to pretend that the problem would go away while the Europeans, meaning the Germans, will be ring-fencing Greece to make the country ready to collapse. And this may be happening just before our eyes.
So that's Greece, Antonis Papianidis, down in Athens. Joseph Jaffe is the editor of the German newspaper Die Zeit.
The bet, well, has been that the Germans will finally cave in, stop cracking the whip of austerity, but I don't think so. Because who else could come up with the kind of money? The French? No. The Italians? No. The Spaniards? No. So if there's only one left, even the rich Germans don't have bottomless pockets.
I wonder, though, if this won't somehow become a problem politically for Mrs. Merkel, because her voters, her electorate will see people in Greece and France not following the austerity course. And what's to prevent the average German citizen from saying, well, we're not going to keep giving these guys money and giving them bailouts. How are we going to do that?
First of all, Mrs. Merkel is not facing any election. The next one is next year. And the Germans are the only country, I mean, only large country, who are doing pretty well. I mean, their unemployment is falling rather than rising, and the deficit is coming down to almost zero over the next year or so.
Hmm. What do you make of the entente that had existed between Mrs. Merkel and President Sarkozy, now with Mr. Hollande?
There's no Europe without Germany and France. Now, the question is, who is going to adapt to whom?
Joseph Joffe of the German newspaper Die Zeit, in a little European whip-around right there. On Wall Street today, traders couldn't have cared less about Europe. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's not likely immigration policy is going to be a big national issue in November. Congress and the White House agreed to disagree on that one a couple of years ago. Locally, though, it's much more of a concern, depending, of course, on where you are. We took you up to Napa Valley last fall to examine the gap between rich and poor in California's wine-growing region. Latinos are soon going to be the majority there. And while locals debate the cost of immigration, a new report offers some food for thought, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
Immigrants contribute about $1 billion to Napa County's $7 billion economy. That's one figure from a report on the fiscal impact of immigration in the area. Terrence Mulligan with the Napa Valley Community Foundation commissioned the study.
We wanted to bring some facts to the table and disprove some misconceptions.
Mulligan hears people say things like immigrants are a burden on social services, but the economic evidence suggests otherwise.
What we spend in Napa County on services to immigrants and their children is proportional to their share of population in public health and public benefits.
Another complaint, immigrants don't pay their fair share of taxes. That's false, says Randy Capps, a senior policy analyst with the Migration Policy Institute. He conducted the study.
They pay state and local taxes roughly in proportion to their population.
The fiscal impact of immigration is lower, the report found, because local employers often pay for health insurance, even for agricultural workers.
Having private health insurance coverage lowers the public health care costs quite a bit.
There is one area where the report found that the children of Hispanic immigrants use a disproportionate amount of services: public education. But Cap says it's important to invest in those students since they represent the area's future workforce. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Yeah, we all love to complain about high gas prices. So far, though, not a whole lot of us are putting our money where our mouths are and actually buying cars that don't need gas. Electric vehicle sales have been slow, but that's still not stopping automakers from introducing new choices. Today, Toyota unveiled the much-anticipated RAV4 EV. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has that story.
Expectations were high for Toyota's new electric RAV4. The company partnered with high-end electric car maker Tesla. And today's rollout with Toyota USA General Manager Bob Carter, it was all show and superlatives.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I present to you our all-new RAV4 EV.
So you might expect the press person with Toyota to be equally gaga. You'd be surprised.
There really isn't a strong economic reason to purchase these vehicles right now.
John Hansen is communications manager for Toyota. The RAV4 EV will cost just about $50,000, more than twice the cost of the RAV4 that uses gas.
It'll be a vehicle that will require 5 to 6 hours of charging time.
Altogether, says Hansen?
That's a situation we think that will appeal to a fairly limited number of consumers.
Whoa! Why the soft sell? Hansen says Toyota's just trying to get a sense of how many people might want these cars, what the market might be. Mike Vanukirk from J.D. Power says there are a couple of reasons to keep expectations low.
the biggest barrier is still going to remain that price. The cost to invest in an electric vehicle is considerably higher than what you need to pay for a comparable vehicle in that same class.
Plus, he says drivers have range anxiety about how far the cars can go without charge. And newer, higher MPG cars pose their own form of competition.
That allows me to do a little better today, get me a little better mileage, and I'll wait. I'll wait for the electric vehicles to really kind of take root within the industry.
Toyota expects to sell only 2,600 RAV4 EVs over the next 3 years, but thinks the market is there and will grow along with technology. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
We spent Friday around here, as I'm sure a lot of you did, thinking about yet another so-so unemployment report and what people might be doing about it. And then we came across a Bloomberg column from economists Betsy Stevenson and Justin Wolfers about work sharing. That's the official name for everybody works fewer hours, but we all get to keep our jobs. Of course, then everybody also gets paid less. But now with a little bit of money from the feds, states are starting to offer some of those reduced hour workers a partial unemployment check. So same job, fewer hours, nobody gets laid off. Justin, Betsy, it's good to talk to you.
Always a pleasure, Kai.
Great to be here.
There's an economic rationale for this, right? Because, Justin, as you point out in this piece, the way the system for years has operated is that it makes sense to lay people off. It's economically smart to fire people, right?
Yep. Unfortunately, that's true. You fire 10% of your workers, they get unemployment insurance. You keep all your workers and cut their time by 10%. No one gets unemployment insurance. And so that tilts the playing field towards firing people rather than cutting their hours, which a lot of workers would prefer.
So, Betsy, run me through the Middle Class Tax Relief and Job Creation Act that the president signed this spring. What does it do that might change this? And then let's talk about where it goes from there.
So what the president's proposal does is it creates a federal work-sharing program that gives just a kickstart. And if states in the meantime adopt a permanent program, they're going to get some financial incentives through the federal government to help compensate them for the costs of adoption and promotion.
So, Justin, American Public Media could cut my hours by 10%, and then I would get some kind of prorated unemployment benefits. Is that the basic idea?
You would get a tenth of the unemployment insurance earned by a high-paid radio personality. Absolutely.
So that's why it's still state-based, right? The states determine how much your UI check amount is, and you would get a prorated amount. So it really would be 10% of what you would get if you were laid off. That gives people and gives employers a temporary period of time to figure out whether or not they're going to be able to boost their employment back up to full levels.
And then on the back end, Justin, I imagine it gives employers some flexibility because they have, instead of having to hire and bring on new people, they've got this trained core ready to get back up to full employment.
Absolutely. So you keep workers in the workforce, keeps them job ready, the jobs ultimately return, and you can ramp up production very quickly.
But, you know, there's actually another aspect of it that people often don't think about, particularly for small employers. It's really painful to lay people off because you typically don't have a bunch of workers with absolutely identical skills, all who do the exact same thing. And when you lay someone off, your other workers need to fill in for that person who's gone. And that can be challenging. So if instead you're cutting everyone's hours, that's really what scaling back production looks like. Doing all the same tasks, but doing fewer of them.
Betsy, this doesn't do anything for people who've now, in this economy, been out of work for 18 months, 20 months, 27 months, right? If this pilot program kicks in, it's only going forward.
Well, that's true. It's for new layoffs, new reductions. But what this entire economy needs, what everyone needs, is for there to be new hiring and fewer people looking for those jobs.
Here's the way to think about it.
Yeah.
You own a business.
Mm-hmm.
You're thinking about hiring someone. But one of the things you're worried about is this recovery going to last? You don't want to hire someone thinking you're going to have to fire them next week. What work sharing would do is you can hire them, realizing if you do hit slower times, you'll just cut their hours a little. So it reduces the uncertainty of hiring new people, and that's the way in which it helps those who are unemployed today.
Not that economists ought to come up with policies that are going to fix all this stuff, but how to put this? Where have you guys been? Because the economy's 4 years into a recession now. The Germans have been doing this for a while. It's not like this is new.
this problem was raised in the 1990s. People have known about it. I think if you want the truth, why did it take so long to get something like this passed? It's a small fix. This is not going to, turn around an economy that lost 9 million jobs. But it is going to help. And I think we sometimes have to do the small things because small things add up to big things.
Economists Betsy Stevenson and Justin Wolfers, they're visiting at Princeton University this year. Thanks a lot, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
No, thanks. It's good talking with you.
Coming up, our series Food for 9 Billion continues.
You have a bucket with a big hole in it. You shouldn't be going around, running around the landscape trying to find more water to keep that bucket full. You fix the leak in the bucket.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials fell 29 points today, 0.2%, closed at 13,008. That's 008. In case you're keeping track. The NASDAQ ticked up a point, a fraction of 1%, wrapped up at 29.57. The S&P 500 was flat, held at 13.69. Bank of America rose nearly 3% today. Wells Fargo galloped up 1.5%. Morgan Stanley pocketed about 1% today. American International Group took off 3% today after the Treasury Department said it's going to sell off shares of the company that it holds. The government, by the way, says it could profit as much as $15 billion from the AIG bailout. You're going to want to see the figures on that one before you believe it. Tyson Foods flew up more than 3% after beating analyst estimates. Walt Disney reeled in 2% today based on the success of The Avengers. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The 2012 Congressional Ceremony celebrating Asian Pacific American Heritage Month takes place at the U.S. Capitol Visitor Center. Find a nice shiny apple to bring to school. Tomorrow is National Teacher Day. And she's gone from Little House on the Prairie to Dancing with the Stars. Actress Melissa Gilbert turns 48. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There are plus or minus 7 billion people now living on this planet. By the middle of the century, the United Nations tells us it's going to be 9 billion. And among the many, many questions that that raises, a big one is how are we going to feed them all? The answer is complicated. It's a mix of culture and science, traditions and politics, all affecting the global food supply. And here's part of the science. The average person drinks a couple of quarts of water every day, but it takes more than 1,000 times that to produce a day's worth of food. That's obviously a problem everywhere, but especially in India, where scientists say nearly a third of that country's underground aquifers are already in critical condition, and they worry that the country is headed for a full-blown water crisis. So today on our series Food for 9 Billion, John Miller went to India to introduce us to a man who's trying to do something about that.
How are you?
Great. How are you?
I'm fine.
Rajendra Singh lives in a patch of forest hours from anywhere in the dry hills of eastern Rajasthan. It's dark when I get there. We eat dinner on the ground by an open fire. Then he leads me to his office, lights a candle, settles on a mattress, and tells me how he came to be famous as the water man.
When I came here, I don't know about the water management. I don't know the water engineering. My background is the medical science.
This was the 1980s, and Singh had recently finished a degree in traditional Indian medicine. Inspired by Gandhi, he decided to move to the poorest, driest, most godforsaken place in his area and build a health clinic and a school.
After 7 months, one old man told me, Rajendra, we don't need medicine and education. We need water. Without water, we can't survive.
But Singh knew nothing about water, so he asked the old man what he should do, and the old man told him he should do what folks here used to do, build a little dam to catch the rainwater that comes during the short but intense annual monsoon.
So I start digging.
And kept digging for 4 years.
Someday 6 hours, someday 8 hours, someday 12 hours.
The water shortage back then was a sneak preview of the crisis India is facing today. For decades, the government had encouraged individual farmers to dig wells to tap into the groundwater. More than 20 million did. Food production went way up, and the water level went way down. In dry places like this, it wasn't long before farmers couldn't reach it. Villages emptied out. The social fabric started to fray.
When I came here, just old women and old men and some child living here, because no water.
Not that it never rained. It just all came at once, and most of it ran off. Rajendra Singh finally finished digging his pond just in time for the monsoon.
And my structure full with water.
Not only did the pond fill up, but the wells nearby started to fill. The dam wasn't just storing the water on the surface, it was sending it back into the ground, recharging the aquifer. It was just one pond, about 3.5 acres, but it was greening 500 acres around it. People from neighboring villages came to see.
So the wonderful thing is, in the 5th year, more than 30 villages start the work. The next year, in 200 villages.
Today, he says more than 1,200 villages have built more than 10,000 rainwater harvesting structures over an area larger than the state of Delaware. 7 rivers that were dry most of the year are now flowing year-round. Farmers are back, there's plenty of food, and Rajendra Singh is the best-known figure in what's become a national grassroots rainwater harvesting movement.
Come.
The next morning, Singh shows me around the rustic campus he's built as a sort of water education center. Peacocks and monkeys live in a forest that didn't used to be here. Singh is in his early 50s with a broad face and a mostly white beard. When he's excited, which is a lot, you can see the whites all around the irises of his eyes.
Yes, it is the completely arid area, no grasses, no tree, no moisture. But now, beautiful tree come up. Beautiful grass is coming up. Very healthy soil. And we are also healthy.
I can see the changes when I head out with Singh to look at projects. The valleys are green with fields of mustard and yellow flower. Villages are full of kids, both human and goat. Around noon, we stop at a stone and concrete dam, almost 150 yards long, built by villagers with little outside help.
This work made by the community effort. No grant from the government, no grant from the World Bank or UN, nothing.
Singh says rainwater harvesting is only part of the reason this area is back from the brink. He's also fought to keep out water-guzzling industries like breweries and mines. He's convinced villagers to plant trees on the hillsides and to change the way they manage their crops, in some cases burying pots with holes in them to deliver water to plants drip by drip.
Water harvesting is not the solution, but water conservation and community-driven, decentralized water management is the solution for my country.
All of which makes perfect sense to Sanjay Pahuja, a water expert with the World Bank. He says rainwater harvesting has been great, especially for raising awareness, but the more urgent work is on reducing demand.
You have a bucket with a big hole in it. You shouldn't be going around, running around the landscape trying to find more water to keep that bucket full. You fix the leak in the bucket.
He says that can be done mainly with existing technology, like drip irrigation or leveling fields or just planting crops that need less water.
If we look at the gap between supply and demand in 2050, 80% of that gap can be closed purely by these improvements which are going to increase water efficiency on the farms without doing anything else.
For Pahuja, the biggest challenge is scaling up, which doesn't necessarily mean thinking big. He says conditions can be dramatically different from place to place, so the key is to let communities take charge. But that takes coordination. With more than 600,000 villages, you can't count on charismatic personalities like Rajendra Singh to pop up wherever you need them. Singh now spends most of his time trying to influence India's water policies. He says there has been progress. Official attitudes are starting to change. In the meantime, work continues back home. Late in the day, we walk a couple of miles up a dry valley to the mouth of a steep box canyon. About a dozen men and women are clawing at the earth with picks, carrying metal bowls full of rocks on their heads, dumping the rocks on a pile. The ground looks hopelessly parched, but a man named Harshaye, age 65, says they'll be farming here next year. And they'll have drinking water and birds, and they'll build a temple so they can worship by the waterside. Singh beams with approval.
So this is the change. When I start, that time no hope, my dear. But now, not only hope, confidence.
Rajendra Singh has learned a lot since he arrived here 27 years ago about water, about geology, about engineering, about politics. He's also learned that when you're facing long odds, confidence can be a very powerful tool. In Rajasthan, India, I'm John Miller for Marketplace.
Our series, Food for 9 Billion, is a collaboration with Homelands Productions, the Center for Investigative Reporting, and PBS NewsHour. The rest of the stories in the series and a photo shoot from this one are online, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a very quick primer on the brewing controversy at Yahoo. Third Point, which is a hedge fund that owns 6% of the company, is threatening trouble if a discrepancy on Yahoo CEO Scott Thompson's resume isn't investigated thoroughly. Seems Mr. Thompson claims a BA in computer science and accounting when he only majored in accounting. Everyday investors, though, hedge funds aside, couldn't really care less. Yahoo shares up 1.3% today. All right, that's it. That's Marketplace from APM on this Monday. Today, the Dow down 29 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ ticked up a point, a fraction of 1%. S&P 500 was flat, ended right where it started. Our producers include Gina Delvac, Millie Jefferson, and Fiona Ng. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.